Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
The Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Gala Shower, Hour 4 of The Fan Morning Show for your podcast listeners. The Blue Jays. The trade deadline came and passed, and there will be some new faces on the Toronto Blue Jays. Maybe not the faces that everybody wanted and desired, but nonetheless, we will learn about them throughout today's show and throughout today on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Blair Barker up next. You got Jays Talk Plus. You'll hear a lot about the new guys. But before we get into Blue Jays trade talk with Shai Davidi, and then after that break, Connor Orr, a little NFL whip around, we're going to talk about Vin Scully, who passed away last night. The most iconic, greatest sports broadcaster of all time. If you grew up with sports, you grew up with Vin Scully. He was the longest tenured broadcaster with any single team in pro sports history. But that aside, he was just an eloquent storyteller, a wonderful, gracious person, extremely well-respected, not only around baseball, but the world of sports. You know, it's an icon whose voice that we lost. We have some audio clips of Vin, and we'll play that now, and you can reminisce.
May God give you for every storm a rainbow.
Up along first, behind the bag, it gets through Buckner. Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it.
For every tear, a smile.
Franklin set, Wayne ready, and Deal swung on. High fly ball to deep right field. Wherever it goes, the Dodgers have won, and it's a grand slam home run.
For every care, a promise.
And look who's coming up. High fly ball into right field. She is gone.
And a blessing in each trial.
Ninth, 6-5 Philadelphia. Stottlemyre and Castillo throwing in case of extra innings. Fastball is hit to left field. Down the line, in the corner. Home run.
For every sigh, a sweet song, and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say.
That was Vin Scully. Some of his calls, some of his memorable moments, and we will miss you as well, Vin. A wonderful, wonderful, honest, great, good man. We've lost him, but he'll always be a memory for all of us sports fans, as those people that grew up listening to him. Text in at 590-590 if you have any Vin Scully memories. I know today was a text line day for us on the Fan Morning Show. We called it Weigh In Wednesday instead of Text Line Tuesday. So we do have some texts throughout. I can sprinkle them in here. Will from Oshawa just texted in. I would listen to Vin Scully read the phone book. Rest in peace, the best to ever do it. I think you're not alone. I saw lots of great stories on Twitter of people that had encounters with Vin Scully on the road, wherever. And he was, you know, just very gracious in terms of what people wanted him to read stuff. He would do it. He knew his impact, you know, was more than just sports as well. A lot of really lovely memories coming out. I'm sure we'll see some great memorial tributes for him throughout the next little while. So keep your texts coming today. Any Vin Scully memories, well wishes, we'll get into that. Let's get into some Blue Jays talk now. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB insider and columnist, joins me this morning. Thanks for coming on, Shai.
No problem, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Talking a lot of Blue Jays over the last couple of days. Today, the dust has settled. I guess the trade grades is kind of the way we kick it off. Were you underwhelmed, overwhelmed, or maybe properly whelmed with how the Jays shook out yesterday?
It's interesting. I think if you look at it from an initial standpoint, you're kind of like, meh, right? Mm-hmm. It's not, there's not a lot of sexy in this. The more you sort of break it down, you're like, okay, I get this. This is the Blue Jays are doing a little bit for now, a little bit for the future. they, you know, they're doing a responsible spend of their prospect capital. In a lot of ways, it checks multiple boxes, which is the way they like to operate. So they addressed a lot of holes. Could they have done more? Did they need to do a little bit more in the bullpen? Probably. But they're deeper with Whit Merrifield and how he protects them across the roster. You know, Anthony Bass and Zach Pop definitely bolster the relief group. And they've got a depth starter who's competent, which they didn't have before, in Mitch White. And he's got a bit of upside and can be a part of things for an extended period. So, you know, I feel like if the Tampa Bay Rays had had this deadline, everybody would be like, oh, that's pretty clever work. But, you know, the Blue Jays have done some big game hunting in recent years. And because there wasn't big game hunting here, it maybe doesn't feel quite as effective of a deadline haul as it probably will turn out to be.
You're actually way more positive and level-headed than what we had for the first couple hours. Well, you know, I had JD on my show, so that's kind of how it goes.
There's no level-headed there.
No, there's none. Maybe one of the things that's been frustrating trying to evaluate, for me at least, was there was all these rumors and discussion that the Jays were going to be the most aggressive team come the deadline. And I think maybe that shifted my perspective on how to grade how the weekend went, because they didn't seem to be aggressive, or they were right on the cusp. And is that kind of the approach that you got, or is that, you know, the media or, you know, insiders kind of getting it wrong at times?
I think there's a little bit of everything. And the thing we have to kind of keep in mind is that the deadline is oftentimes what's the art of the possible. Mm-hmm. And just because you want player X, you know, if the other team doesn't want the prospects you're willing to give up for them, or, you know, wants your elite guys for someone who's maybe not quite elite, then you're not going to be able to make those deals. And so, you know, I feel like the one deal that if the Blue Jays had managed to pull off, then people would probably be feeling a lot different would be the Montas Trevino deal with the A's that the Yankees got. And, you know, what I was told was that, you know, the Blue Jays were sort of neck and neck with them, and that, you know, the Yankees inclusion of Waldichuk and Medina is what tipped the scales. And, you know, I don't know this for a fact, but common sense would say that the A's would have liked those players a little bit more than what the Blue Jays were willing to offer. And so they don't get it. So, you know, I think that's a part of the deadline that can be frustrating. But there are times where you have to pull yourself out of your comfort zone and maybe surrender, a player that you don't want. But the way that I would expect that the Blue Jays to have looked at it was that they didn't feel that that was worthwhile, that it was more important to preserve the players that the other teams had requested. And that's why things played out the way they did.
Do you think that the Blue Jays prospect system, I mean, there's a lot to break down with this. They've got some great top guys, and that it seems like not a lot of depth. Do you think that maybe teams possibly just didn't see the value or enough that the Blue Jays could offer without giving up like a Moreno or somebody really high up?
Right. Well, I mean, prospect evaluation is oftentimes beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? And what typically happens is deals get done where, you know, maybe another team values one of your prospects maybe a bit more highly than you do, or you know, somebody is seen as potentially surplus in your system, and that makes you more willing to part with them, but it fits another team. So, you know, is that possible? Sure. You know, they just could have liked the other prospects that were on offer in certain deals. And, you know, we saw some players that didn't move at all, and especially when you look at the Cubs and a lot of the Tigers relievers. So clearly they just didn't feel there was, you know, enough lining up there to make those deals happen. So, you know, that's entirely possible. And look, the Blue Jays have now dealt away three of their past four or something like that, or four of their past five first-round draft picks. You know, they certainly moved a lot of young players. But part of being an effective management team is knowing which prospects you better keep. And, you know, now the question comes for the Blue Jays, you know, do they keep the right guys?
Did they keep the right guys is tough because you see a lot of big name players. It felt like we could have seen the Blue Jays in on if they were able to give them up. Do you find that the Blue Jays prospect system, how do you evaluate that? Is it an asset right now? Is it one of those kind of in the middle tough things for you as an outsider to understand? Or would you have been happier if the Blue Jays got rid of some of these big name prospects with a win now mentality instead of maybe punting it to next year or after the season?
So basically, you want them to be AJ Preller or kind of operate the way that they're
I guess right now. So.
I think that's the balance that they're trying to strike. And you know, even going back to Alex Anthopoulos here, right? Mm. He had a group of prospects that, if he believed in the player and he thought that player was going to be part of that future, that player wasn't going anywhere, right? And you just think about, like, the way they, you know, acquired or kept Devin Travis, Aaron Sanchez, Roberto Osuna, Dalton Pompey, some of the other young players, Kevin Pillar. You know, there are lots of young players that the Blue Jays kept. You know, they had an opportunity to trade Rowdy Tellez for Ben Zobrist in 2015, but they believed that Rowdy Tellez had a chance to be a part of the future, so they kept him. You know, that's how all teams operate. And, you know, the A.J. Preller approach in San Diego, you know, that's just a unique animal, and he's operating in a way that, you know, everybody, you know, save for maybe Jerry DePoto in Seattle, doesn't work in terms of just being, I don't want to say reckless, but pretty audacious and daring and saying, I'm not worried about the future value because I'll recreate prospects. You know, I think the approach that the Blue Jays have tried to take, for better or for worse, is that, you know, they want to be judicious. They want, especially as their prospects are getting closer to the big leagues, to see how they're going to play out and what that's going to look like at the big league level, give them, an opportunity, make sure that, you know, they're keeping the right guys. By and large, so far, it seems that they have. There aren't really prospects or young players that they've traded away that you're like, oh no. And, you know, they've acquired lots of players who have helped in the current group. When you think about, you know, Teoscar Hernandez and Santiago Espinal and several others. So you don't want, I think the Blue Jays are trying to walk that line and are trying to be balanced and understanding that, you know, they've got a roster that's going to be getting more expensive. They're going to need their young players both to replenish, provide some, some cost efficiency on or payroll efficiency on your roster, and be assets for future deals as well.
So during the trade deadline over the last, 7 days, do you think that Jay's idea of what they want to accomplish this season shifts at all when you see other teams such as the Yankees, the Astros grabbing some large names, seemingly going all in? Does that actually influence the decision to say, hey, maybe the window isn't right now? Maybe we need to be a bit more cautious? Or are they still going in with the same steadfast approach?
I mean, I would hope not. And if you need to sort of operate with your group and what you need your group to do. And, you know, even as things stood, and this is from a couple of days ago, but if you look at sort of World Series odds on Fangraphs, Blue Jays still had the sixth or seventh best odds to win the World Series. And they were, you know, a fair bit back of, say, the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Mets and the Astros. But they're up there. That's a good opportunity. You don't take that lightly. And so, you know, they worked to address holes that they had, right? They needed more position player depth so that if one of their key players went down, they had a capable replacement. And now they do that. Now they do in Whit Merrifield. You know, they needed to bolster their bullpen. And they have another, you know, leverage arm in Anthony Bass, and someone who could potentially grow into a leverage arm, but is certainly a more capable mid-innings reliever in Zach Pop. And, you know, they needed someone to protect their rotation in the event something happened. And they got Mitch White, who's got some upside in the future, but can also, maybe fit into that Ross Stripling mold where he goes back and forth between roles. And that's incredibly valuable. So, they did things that they needed to do. They clearly were trying to do some other things as well that didn't pan out. And, if you're thinking, if everything that you do is relative to what teams around you are doing, that's when you can pull yourself out of your plan and maybe make some longer term mistakes that you end up regretting.
Was there anything down to the end of the deadline? Yesterday was quite quiet, and then all of a sudden there's a little bit of a flurry of action, with 5 to 10 minutes left. Was there anything that you might know of that was really close that we didn't hear, or anything that they were a little bit disappointed on in the dying moments?
I'm sure there was. I haven't had a chance to really dig deep super into that. But, any team in their position should be exploring every possible deal, that's out there. And so, I'm sure that they were in on a number of different things. There certainly was a lot of chatter about Noah Syndergaard. To some degree, I know they were engaged on Raisel Iglesias, who ended up going into Atlanta. That would have been a bit of a more out of character acquisition for them, because they haven't put a lot of money into the bullpen and relievers to this point. So I'm not sure how thoroughly engaged they were on that one. But there are always opportunities, and there are always sort of backup deals and different ways you can turn in case things don't work out. And, I'm sure that we'll find out more about that in the days ahead.
So we know how the fan base feels right afterwards and today with the dust settling. But how do you think the clubhouse vibes after this? Yesterday we saw multiple reports that, the Jays were huddled around the TV. They were really optimistic about getting somebody of substance and to shake up their roster and give them that boost. And ultimately, I don't know if they'd be as excited as they would have been with the haul that they got. Is that something that concerns you, or is an interesting storyline moving forward on the comments that the team makes and how they respond to the trade deadline?
Well, I mean, again, it's still fresh. I didn't have a chance to talk to too many players. The ones that I did just felt that they got better. And I would think they probably feel a little bit like some fans do in terms of, this is not the big, flashy, shock and awe type of deadline haul that, maybe gets you instantly excited. But I think once it starts playing out, they'll start seeing that, okay, well, this fills some holes and it gets better. And, players by nature are competitive. They're going to see what the other teams are doing. They're going to be like, well, I want us to do that too. Mm-hmm. But ultimately it comes down to, is the team better? The team is better. And did they do enough? We'll find out in the next couple of months.
Mm-hmm. With the addition, just two more for me here. On the addition with the Merrifield trade, does that give you any concern, additional concern, with where George Springer's at currently with that injury and the potential that there's a little bit of a backup cushion now with that acquisition?
He looked really uncomfortable on Saturday in a way that he has, or to a degree that he hadn't previously looked. And he's had the 3 days off since. He resumed some baseball activity yesterday. And we'll see whether he's in the lineup this afternoon and what he looks like then. But that was the first time where it was clearly visible that he was being limited and being impacted by the elbow issue. Mm-hmm. So that's a bit of a flag right there that you start paying attention to. And I don't think that they made the Merrifield deal strictly because of George Springer, but now they are better insulated and have more depth on their roster to sustain something like that, whether it's George Springer or someone else.
Well, let's hope that that is just a minor blip in the rest of this Blue Jays season. Before we let you go, any comments and any memories of Vin Scully, who passed away last night, any growing up listening to him, or any times you got to meet him potentially before we let you go?
Yeah, I mean, I got to meet him once briefly when the Dodgers made one of their rare visits to Toronto. It was very brief, but he was gentlemanly, as you can imagine. But, for me, growing up and listening to him on the old NBC Game of the Week, It was a real gateway to the wider baseball world in the time before, the satellite television and being able to access any game you wanted. And, he was just listening to him was like magic, mm-hmm. right? It's just the perfect tone of voice, pacing, rhythm of the game, sense of the moment, all those things. And I was thinking back to that classic call on the Kirk Gibson home run in game one of the 88 World Series. And just the way he let it breathe, he says the kind of fly ball deep left, there she's gone, and then just kind of lets the scene play itself out. And after a while, he says, in a year, it's been so improbable, the impossible has happened. It was just amazing, kind of like Tom Cheek just on the Joe Carter home mm-hmm. run call. It's just perfection. So an unbelievable loss for the baseball world. And anyone who had the privilege of listening to him, that'll stick with you forever.
Yeah, certainly has that amazing awareness of pacing and knowing when to allow the moment to breathe and that eloquence. Definitely we're going to hear lots more. We played some off the top of his calls, but lots more tributes to come. Shai, I appreciate you coming on this morning and looking forward to reading more of your breakdowns and insight on the Jays trade deadline. Thanks.
No problem. Have a great day.
You too. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB insider and columnist. You can read all his stuff at sportsnet.ca, follow his Twitter, and make sure you're getting all your Jays news today and always at sportsnet.ca and on our radio station, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. As I said, lots coming up down the road here in terms of Jays breakdowns. We did get a new player, Zach Pop, who I think is a pretty elite Blue Jays name. That's a positive. We have some audio to play, actually, with some of the new players, Zach Pop and Anthony Bass, who found out they were traded to Toronto. You can hear some excitement in their voice. We're going to play those now.
It's pretty special to be able to go back home and see my family and to play for the Blue Jays. I got a lot of friends, a lot of people rooting for them right now, and to be a part of what they're doing over there is pretty amazing. They got a great team over there, and I'm lucky to be a part of it. They're doing some pretty special things all around the field.
This is my first time being traded at the deadline. It's exciting, right? You go into a team that has a chance to go to the postseason, which as players is what we always want to do. Our end goal is to win the World Series, so that part is exciting. Going to Toronto for that opportunity. Obviously a familiar place. I was with them in 2020, so that'll be a nice transition for me.
So that was Zach Pop followed by Anthony Bass. Obviously, Zach Pop's a Brampton guy, a hometown kid. I'm sure that's an exciting move for him, and we've seen Anthony Bass before, so kind of a return to a place you know well. Got me thinking of best Blue Jays names of all time. Zach Pop, I think, is a super fun one. Here's some others. Dennis Lamp. Junior Lake. I had to really go on Wikipedia deep here in the Jake Lamb. Scott Diamond, that's a perfect baseball name. Scott Diamond, Homer Bush, Socrates Brito, remember that one? Bud Black, Uninori Kawasaki, Troy Tulowitzki, Rowdy Tellez. Blue Jays have had some fun names. Buck Martinez, of course, and Dalton Pompey. Text in. Who am I forgetting in terms of best Blue Jays names of all time? Zach Pop. I don't think he's at the top of that list, but he's got an opportunity to be in the running. There's some really cool ones coming in. I also read today in the A-list hour of the Fan Morning Show, or in our Something to Chew On, was that Toronto was just named a top 10 city in the world from reputable sources, not just, me. So maybe that's another positive. I'm looking for all the good spins on the trade deadline. Some Jays are coming. They're excited. Toronto, a top 10 city in the world. There's always a silver lining. Looking for the positives here. We're going to take a break. Talk about some crazy NFL news with Connor Orr. Dolphins, they're in trouble. Big time. A six-month investigation was concluded, and there was some severe rulings handed out. Look around. The Bills, the rest of the league, how things are shaking out. Continue to text in your thoughts on who has the best Blue Jays name of all time. I'm seeing some trickle in here on the text line 590-590, as well as any messages or memories of Vin Scully, who passed away last night. We're going to take a break, and we'll get to that after on the Fan Morning Show, the Ailish Hour.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
We're back on the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. It's the Ailish Hour. Subscribe, download, and rate 5 stars for our podcast on the Fan Morning Show, wherever you get your podcasts. Lots more Blue Jays talk to come, but I didn't want to exhaust our listeners because there's lots going on all over the world, NFL-related especially. So let's get a little roundup here with Connor Orr, NFL writer at SportsIllustrated.com. Thanks for joining this morning.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Of course. We're excited to, you know, see the first NFL preseason game this week, Jags and Raiders. It's exciting, I'm sure, for you as well to get back into the grind. What are you most looking forward to just learning over the next few weeks? Preseason's preseason, but is there some things, a storyline that you're really going to be dialed in on over the next couple weeks?
Well, I don't think there was much of an offseason with both everything that's been going on with Deshaun Watson and obviously the stunning penalties that were handed down yesterday. So, you know, for me, it feels like anything that's happening on the field, at least from a national perspective, is miles mm-hmm. away in terms of just pales in importance in terms of, you know, the integrity of the game is on the line with, you know, the Stephen Ross investigation and with the Deshaun Watson investigation. The NFL is kind of entering its zero hour here on deciding whether or not they can appeal. So that, to me, I mean, you know, I don't know if they tried to use training camp to sort of buffer the news and maybe it backfired, but it seems like that's kind of the situation we're in right now.
Well, let's start with that Dolphins news. So following 6-month investigation, they were proven to have violated anti-tampering policy on 3 occasions from 2019 to 2022 in conversations with Tom Brady and Sean Payton. So the punishment here, losing their first round draft pick in 2023, a third round pick in 2024, plus Stephen Ross being fined $1.5 million, the vice chairman not able to attend meetings, also being fined $500,000. Okay, so that's a lot. Initial thoughts from you on the severity of this ruling?
I thought, you know, for as blatant as they were in their attempts to do this, that the penalty would have been a little bit harsher. And I think what is really surprising here is that the league has kind of put the tampering allegations forward when really the mm-hmm. basis of this entire thing was Brian Flores' lawsuit. And there's certainly echoes of racial discrimination there and, you know, allegations of outright tanking, which, you know, I thought the league's findings were pretty fascinating in terms of that, where they basically addressed it by saying, oh, the Dolphins owner was just joking about that, you know, and I think that that's been really hard for some people to stomach in the NFL.
So the tanking stuff for me is also a huge, it tried to get like almost like slid under the rug in terms of not talking about it. But there's just, in my opinion, there's really no way that they weren't tanking. I'm not sure your opinion on it, but it really did seem that way. And I don't know if this is actually going to stop that moving forward since they didn't address it.
Well, it's funny. I mean, I think if they didn't have Brian Flores, you would have, as a coach who did a phenomenal job mm-hmm. that year and coached one of the worst rosters that I think we've ever seen to 5 wins, if you didn't have him there, I think you would have had a stronger case for tanking, which is super ironic. You know, they probably would have gone 0-16 if they didn't have him as their head coach. But, yeah, I mean, that was as naked an attempt to tear down a roster as I think we've seen. The Cleveland Browns also were investigated by the NFL for tanking, and we saw a similar path there taken by them. But, yeah, I don't know. It's a fine line that they're trying to walk where they're saying that teams can rebuild this aggressively while also maintaining this facade for gambling companies, which is really kind of the straw that is stirring the drink right now.
Do you think that any of this outcome, whether it was the lack of outcome in terms of the tanking or the heaviness of the anti-tampering policy, will actually make any sustainable changes NFL-wide, or are any owners, you know, maybe pausing a little bit on their plans to be shady this upcoming season?
Well, we just had one ignore a congressional subpoena on his yacht in international waters for a couple weeks. So I think the plan for billionaires to be shady billionaires is still full steam ahead in terms of that. But I'm interested in what Roger Goodell does, right? Because mm-hmm. his job is to control this, and you really can't, right? I mean, nobody has told any of these owners what to do for their entire lives. They've ignored the FBI. They've ignored, you know, Congress. They've ignored presidents, you know. So it's not like, you know, the commissioner is going to say, hey, you guys should stop this. And everyone's like, oh, okay, well, yeah, now I'm definitely going to not do that anymore. So, you know, I think it's just, they just have to be really careful. You know, I think integrity of the game is more important than ever when you have people wagering on stuff.
Certainly, I know the betting is now, you know, up here a little bit more prevalent now that it's legalized in Canada. Not that people weren't finding a way around that as well, but I think that that takes a huge toll in terms of what fans want and what fans expect from the NFL. Excuse my ignorance here, but what does it mean for a owner to be suspended? Like, what is the actual meaning of that? Like, what will Stephen Ross not be able to do, and what does it mean for his future?
Yeah, so he can't be in the team facility, can't have contact with team employees. And, you know, he spends a majority of his time in New York anyway. So I don't think this is exactly, you know, a rigorous punishment. It will just be him having to do what he normally does during most weeks. But yeah, I mean, I think it's just laughable. And to me, it's just... I give the NFL credit for at least attempting to police mm-hmm. Their owners. You know, I understand how incredibly difficult that is. So for them, I think they're considering it a victory, and more the fact that they actually kind of stood up to one of the 32 bullies in the room and said, hey, you guys have to stop this.
Goodness. And $1.5 million is really just pocket change for these guys. So interesting thing to keep in mind for our listeners is that Miami and the Bucks play scrimmage on the 13th. So it could be interesting television there. Before we move off of this one, do you think this affects Brady at all? Since this was when he was also in the Patriots and now with the Bucks, is there any inclination that you view him differently, or that this is something that not tarnishes his legacy, but is a little bit of an asterisk?
I mean, I think that he removed himself from that when he left New England, and, you know, kind of the specter of Spygate and all that stuff fell away. But now you're pretty centrally involved in one of the biggest scandals in recent NFL history again. And so, you know, can we believe that this is all kind of incidental, and, or, you know, do we, you know, what do we make of this? You know, and I certainly think that you have to include all this, the good and the bad, when it comes to breaking down his complete and total legacy whenever he's finished.
Well, I know there's a lot of Brady fans listening, so I don't think they'll always agree that there could be something negative about his legacy. He's a big figure, obviously, in the NFL world. Okay, so let's bounce over to the Deshaun Watson case. So suspended 6 games with the judge's ruling. It's obviously a very horrible and really plainly disgusting situation going on. The judge, you know, acknowledges that he did engage in sexual assault, but still provides a 6-game suspension. And I thought this was the worst part of the script that I read. She thought that a lengthier suspension would have represented a dramatic shift in culture without providing fair notice to players of what was expected from them and what the follow could be. Just how much is this a moment that the NFL will look back on and the league as a really, really missed opportunity to lay down the law and do something of relevance?
Well, it's interesting, right? I mean, I think that Judge Robinson approached this through, you know, kind of an overly serious legal standard, mm-hmm. you know, and she's saying, I'm working within the framework that you gave me. These players need warning. I think that you and I and most common sense people would say, hey, I can't serially harass 66 women, you know, and I don't need a warning for that, you know, to know that that's a bad thing from my employer. But I think what happened was she, as much as anything else, thumbed her nose at the NFL in her ruling by saying that you guys have been so inconsistent and so vague in everything that here's your opportunity now to rewrite your policy, just like you mm-hmm. did with Ray Rice, to get yourself to a higher threshold in the future. And she's like, you know, if you want me to do your dirty work, you have to put on the books that, like, this kind of thing is wholly unacceptable. Here's how we define sexual violence. all these other things that weren't in the collective bargaining agreement. And so I think that the NFL is certainly going to take that to task, or at least they should. But I'll be interested to see if they use some of her language in there. I mean, she did say that this was the most egregious crime that the NFL had ever investigated. And does the NFL use that as a platform to launch their appeals process? I don't know. The victims some of the victims are staging a press conference on Thursday, mm-hmm. around the time that the NFL's appeals decision would be due. So we'll see if that does anything to move the needle for them.
How much of this just falls on someone like a Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, who's obviously, I think, at hand for some of the criteria and some of the rulings that are outlined in, you know, whether you said the CBA or the rules that the players have to follow?
Well, I think the NFL in general has wanted to appear like they're trying to do their best with everything instead of just doing their best with everything. And, you know, my former colleague, Jenny Rentis, you know, did a great job of outlining, I think, some of the flaws in the process. I mean, the NFL installed this kind of independent investigatory arm, but they were investigating sexual assaults like it was, you know, the 1960s or the 1970s. I mean, they were asking these women what they were wearing. They were doing all these things that would discourage open and honest answers and not making these women feel comfortable. You know, they're working with a dated definition of sexual assault and sexual violence. And so I think this gives the NFL a huge opportunity to actually dig in and do the work and think, you know, hey, how can we actually get out front of this? Now, will they do that, or will they just kind of add another layer of bureaucracy to this process? I don't know, you know, but I think that this has certainly been a wake-up call for them.
Okay, so moving forward, how does something of this change? Like, what are the logistical legal steps, and who would be responsible for making that a tangible goal that the NFL can achieve?
It starts with the owners and the commissioner. I mean, they have to agree that this was gross. You know, they have to agree that this is unacceptable. And, you know, my colleague Mike Rosenberg wrote this. It's kind of on us, right, as analysts, as journalists, as fans, to sort of make it known that this is unacceptable. You know, this is not the kind of player we want, you know, in a league that we root for, that we love. You know, this is not something that this is not something that we'll stand by. And so, you know, I think it's going to take sort of a societal push, and, you know, the NFL needs to see that. They need to see that people are concerned and unhappy and grossed out, and we'll see what happens from there.
Do you think the Cleveland Browns would and should do anything additional in terms of their upcoming year with Deshaun Watson?
I don't think they can. I mean, they handed him that contract and they basically made him the most powerful person in the building. I mean, and there's really nothing that they can do at this point. And I think that their efforts behind the scenes to sort of, you know, already try to make him seem like, whatever you want to call it. I mean, you know, trying to kind of pivot towards the next steps, you know, in just making him the quarterback of the Cleveland Browns, you know, shows that, you know, there's doesn't seem to be a whole lot of I don't know what you want to call it, guilt on their side, remorse. You know, it seems like they're kind of full steam ahead on this.
Well, I appreciate the work that you guys are doing. I mean, you said it pretty bluntly and correctly that it's not only on them, it's on us as journalists as well to make sure that we're talking about this. And I know it's a difficult conversation, so I appreciate that. I'm going to pivot a little bit off of that, unfortunately. It's a tough transition. But Jordan Poyer, big Bills country up here, so we got to ask about that potential injury that happened. I think it was yesterday. He was carted off an elbow injury, which is kind of a weird thing to get carted off from. So it's a bit of a worse feeling. How tough is this a spot for the Bills, especially with his contract extension just kind of pending right now?
Yeah, it's a difficult spot, you know, especially when you're trying to get a guy done on a long-term deal. And because your safeties are really so instrumental to how that defense works. I mean, that's why you went out and got Von Miller. Like, you know, the two of them, depending on the two of them being on the field, I think was a big part of this entire process with Micah Hyde too. And so, you know, if the timing of it is substantial, you know, I mean, a lot of things get complicated, you know, and you hope that the Bills kind of stand by him and do the right thing because he's played a lot of good football there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, before we let you go here, a couple free agents still yet to find a spot. Is there somewhere you think Odell Beckham Jr. lands? Is there somewhere that any of these notable unsigned free agents could go in the next little while?
Probably not. You know, at this point, you wait until week one of the regular season because, you know, then you don't have to lock in the fully guaranteed contract. You kind of just rent and use them as kind of patch hole fillers. Odell Beckham will always have a spot, I think, on an NFL roster. You know, the Rams, returning to the Rams seems like the most likely scenario for him at this point. But we'll see. I mean, that's another ACL injury. He's experienced quite a few of these. And, you know, I think teams are going to be very careful about, you know, I mean, a big part of the Rams Super Bowl game plan hinged on him being healthy. And if you can't depend on that, then it's a difficult ask for a team to bring you back in.
It's an interesting thing to think about as well around NFL trade talk happening, but also in terms of if you're having, you know, leagues, fantasy football leagues. I don't know if you're a big fantasy football guy, but people are starting to get antsy about locking in their rosters, locking in what they're doing. Are you a fantasy football player?
I do. Yeah, I do. I'm playing a neighborhood league. I think it was a good, it's a nice way to meet new friends.
That's very fun.
Meet new people.
What's your fantasy football name? Because I always find that they're really fun and creative at times.
See, I don't have we couldn't figure out how to use the interface.
And
it's just like the two of our last names smashed together, me and my co-manager. So it's very boring.
Well, there's time to change that.
There's time to change it. Most of the other names in the league, I would be very much trouble if I repeated over the radio.
Yeah,
so.
I know what you mean. I can understand where you're going with that. It's an exciting time with the teams back on the field and fantasy football right in the corner. So thank you so much, Connor, for all your work and insight on this. And we will catch up with you in a few weeks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Connor Orr, NFL writer at sportsillustrated.com. You can check out all his great articles there. His Twitter feed as well. You know, he's been doing some hard work on the difficult conversations in NFL right now. And I think you put it great. It's like, it's not really an interesting time on the field right now. It's more about what's happening off the field. So appreciate all that info. And also, we're definitely going to have some fantasy football guests leading up to when everyone's drafts are happening. I know this getting into draft time. Lots of people renting out cottages and doing those big draft parties. I know a couple. Looking also to get into some more leagues. So you can send me an invite. I'm sure we'll have one here at Sportsnet. It's my first fantasy football time at Sportsnet. So waiting for somebody to invite me and start an email chain. If anyone's listening, would love to play some fantasy football. Yeah, that's around the corner. And I definitely have creative names. We'll do that one day in the text line. We can brainstorm some great creative fantasy football names that are appropriate. I know Connor needs some help, clearly, because his was pretty boring. What we talked about at the top of the show, best Blue Jays names of all time, was Zach Pop joining. Is he make your rankings? Well, we got a lot in the text line from you guys. Appreciate you tuning in. It's 590-590. Junior Felix. It's a great one. Darwin Barney. Forgot about that. It was a good one. Wow. Multiple people. Candy Maldonado. Like, I think six of you texted that in. Of course, a really great one. Kevin Barker, never heard of him. That was Tim from Chatsworth, Ontario. That was a great one. Ricky Romero, of course, fan of the show, a big friend. I really like Ricky. He's been on the show, obviously, my show, but also the Fan Morning Show's show a lot, and he works for Sportsnet now. He's all over the place. Ricky Romero. Brent from Hamilton, don't overthink it. The best name of all time is Vernon Wells. Just rolls off the tongue. I couldn't agree more. Vernon Wells, there's just special names like that. Just rolls off the tongue. Ailish Forfar, not one of those. I know people struggle with that one a lot. Joe Cannon, Chris from Waterloo brings that one in. Jimmy Key. BJ Ryan, that was from Matt the Garbage Man, a loyal listener. I like that one too. BJ as in Blue Jays. Daryl and Sudbury, also with Candy Maldonado. Otto the Swatto Vellas. It's spelled incorrectly on the line, but we try our best. Okay, guys. So lots of names coming in. Appreciate you doing that. We're going to do our feel-good story of the day in a moment, but we might have some more thoughts on the Blue Jays trade deadline. A lot of you texting in a little bit of frustration, and I totally understand that. I thought the perspective that Shai brought was also good. You're going to have lots more conversations of that all day long. I think that if you go back and listen to the Fan Morning Show as well, we had Jeff Blair on, we had Ben Ennis on. JD and I bounced it around quite a lot. I think underwhelming is the way to put it. I think definitely when you look around what other people did, that adds to your, I guess, frustration as a fan or your meh, as Shai Davidi put it properly. It's a little bit tough to swallow when you've been linked with these great names, linked with being the hot team going into the trade deadline and ultimately kind of falling up short. We did have some quotes from Ross Atkins. He has one on the pitching staff currently that I thought was interesting. We're going to play that one now just to see what they say in terms of how you spin a deadline of that sort and find some positivity from the team.
Well, we've had our starting pitching has been a clear strength for us all year. I think if you just look across all the entire game, our starting pitching is a clear strength. It has been very effective. The loss of Ryu was a hit, and Ross Stripling stepped right in. The bounce back of Yusei Kikuchi is exceptionally exciting for us. And then to add Mitch White to that group is a very good compliment to an already young core. Obviously, Alek Manoah has been phenomenal. But again, to add Mitch White to that group, to add to our bullpen and Anthony Bass and Zach Pop is very exciting for us.
All right, and one more from Ross Atkins in terms of adding to the young core in a sustainable way, and I guess that's one of the big takeaways from the trade deadline is some youth.
Well, I think it starts with the players that we were so excited about, their ability, the teammate in each of them. You know, we knew these guys really well. Historically, some more on a personal level than others, but just from scouting them over time and as much as you can learn, from your research and learning secondhand from a lot of it. But most importantly, we're excited about their impact, their potential impact in the present and the future. But we've seen the power of keeping this young core that we're so excited about that's already here together and them growing together. So it is attractive to us to think about adding to that young core in a way that is sustainable.
Lots more to come in terms of Blue Jays conversations, what Ross Atkins and the Blue Jays organization had to say about what they did add. That will be all day long. Before we send you off, the feel-good story of the day, Alfonso Davies is donating his World Cup winnings to charity. The Canadian was not born in Canada, but has become a Canadian citizen. He was born in a Ghanaian refugee camp after his parents fled the civil war in Liberia. He came over when he was five, and he takes a lot of pride in becoming a Canadian and how Canada welcomed him and his family in. So he said, "It enabled me to live my dreams. It's a great honor to play for Canada, and I want to give back. So I've decided that I will donate this year's World Cup earnings to charity." World Cup in November, of course, so not sure exactly how much of Canada's proceeds will be won, depending on how they do. Hopefully they are a success, and there's lots more given away to charity, and Davies has been doing some humanitarian stuff in his whole career, but he became an ambassador for the UN Refugee Agency back in 2021 in March, so he's really championing that giving back and making sure that you're more than a player and you're a leader on and off. So thanks, you guys, for listening today. That was the A-List Hour, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.